Well, since the nature of these things is that soon we'll scatter like a covey of quail in all directions, I want to make sure to thank you for allowing Les and I to be here this weekend. I've had so much fun hanging out with her. It's one of the real attractions of my home group is getting to be there with her, and of course being with all of you has been very special. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now this is my battered copy of something called The Greatest Thing in the World, and if you haven't connected with that, it's available as a free PDF download online. I'm sure Tarek's probably got it on his website and so forth. And I was talking on the break, by the way, and something else worth reading that some of my friends and I have a lot of fun playing with are The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. And as a matter of fact, there's an audio recording of John Cleese reading them, and John does a tremendous job here. But essentially, if you want to boil it down for us, what they are is a series of communications between a senior devil and a junior devil. It's demonic sponsorship. it's like from the senior devil to the junior devil, how to mess with humans' minds, you know. And one of the favorite ones he talks about in there is the junior devil's all upset. Oh my gosh, I don't know where I messed up. His prospect has all of a sudden started going to church, and he's praying, and he's got religion, and oh my God, we've lost him and everything else. And the senior devil, I'm paraphrasing, of course, you just said, hey, chill out, calm down. He says, just watch. He says, very soon, he's going to start noticing the defects of all the people that are in the church and in the pews with him. This one dresses badly. This one, her hair is always straggly. That one sings off key, and all and on. And don't we do that in Alcoholics Anonymous? We come around, we have experienced the miracle of recovery and everything else, and then we start noticing the defects of people we're going to meetings with. And we particularly... You know, that group over there doesn't do it right. I mean, they're killing alcoholics left and right. And, you know, these people and that people and, wow, you know, it's so great. So I've got a couple of friends that call it, you know, the senior devil is referred to as the uncle and the junior one as the nephew. So I will get these calls from, you know, nephew, how are you doing today, you know. And it's been a wonderful way to play. But back to Mr. Drummond here. This was an inspiration. The guys who started the Oxford group came out of this. And that was the young people's movement of this day. What this piece here, and we can't go through much of it, but I'll just pull out a piece or two here today. The guy that wrote this was a 29-year-old Scottish evangelical at the time, and he was radical in the church at that time, and he really inspired later on. He died when he was I think 46, something like that. Died quite young, and he lit people on fire. And so when the guys that started the Oxford group were starting to fumble around, this was the one of the inspirations for them. So it's, and if you go through here, I won't break it down for you now, but you'll find some phrases that almost appear word for word in our big book later on, that they floated through a couple of different fellowships, and certainly the concepts here. And the greatest thing in the world here in this case is love. And he breaks it down and uses Corinthians 2, to 2 Corinthians to do this. You may be familiar with it. It's read at a lot of weddings. Love is patient, love is kind, all this kind of good stuff. And he goes through all these qualities of love here and relates them. And at the end of the day, says that, you know, while all this other stuff is good, faith is good, but love is supreme over faith even. And here, and you don't, especially at that time, in the late 1800s, this was written in 1880, if you can believe it, you didn't hear many preachers saying that love was more important than faith. And it was those kind of things that attracted the young people years later that founded the Oxford Group. We're going to talk about step 10 here and hopefully 11 and 12. But to lead into that here, you know, going through the qualities of love here, he lays this out here. He says, the next ingredient in love is a very remarkable one, good temper. And he quotes from the original, love is not easily provoked. Nothing could be more striking than to find this here. We are inclined to look upon bad temper as a very harmless weakness. I don't know about you, but I excuse my bad temper a lot of, you know, just, hey, you know, come on. We speak of it as a mere infirmity of nature, a family failing, a matter of temper, not a thing to take into very serious account in estimating a man's character. And yet here, right in the heart of the analysis of love, it finds its place, and the Bible again and again returns to condemn it as one of the most destructive elements in human nature. The peculiarity of ill temper is that it's the vice of the virtuous. My righteous anger. Those people are doing it wrong. It is often the one blot on an otherwise noble character. You know men who are all but perfect and women who would be entirely perfect, but for an easily ruffled, quick-tempered, or touchy disposition. This compatibility of ill temper with high moral character is one of the strangest and saddest problems of ethics. The truth is, there are two great classes of sins. The sins of the body and the sins of the disposition. The prodigal son may be taken as a type of the first, the elder brother of the second. Now, society has no doubt whatever as to which of these is the worst. Its brand falls without challenge upon the prodigal. You know, he was the guy that was drinking and whoring and doing he's evil, you know. But are we right? We have no balance to weigh one another's sins, and coarser and finer are but human words, but faults of the higher nature may be less venal than those in the lower. And to the eye of him who is love, a sin against love may seem 100 times more base. No form of vice, not worldliness, not greed of gold, not drunkenness itself, does more to unchristianize society than evil temper. For embittering life, for breaking up communities, for destroying the most sacred of relationships, for devastating homes, for withering up men and women, for taking the bloom off childhood, in short, for sheer gratuitous misery-producing power, this influence stands alone. Look at the elder brother, moral, hard-working, patient, and dutiful. Let him get all credit for his virtues. And then look at this man, this baby, sulking outside his own father's door. He was angry, we read. He would not go in. Look at the effect upon the father, upon the servants, upon the happiness of the guest. Judge of the effect upon the prodigal. and how many prodigals are kept out of the kingdom of God by the unlovely character of those who profess to be inside. Analyze as a study in temper the thunder cloud itself as it gathers upon the elder's brow. What is it made of? Jealousy, anger, pride, uncharity, cruelty, self-righteousness, touchiness, doggedness, sullenness. These are ingredients, the ingredients of this dark and loveless soul. In varying proportion, they are also the ingredients of all ill temper. Judge if such sins of the disposition are not worse to live in and for others to live with than sins of the body. Did Christ himself not answer the question himself when he said, I say unto you that the publicans and the harlots go to the kingdom of heaven before you? Publicans are the tax collectors and the harlots are the prostitutes. So, the prostitutes and the tax collectors are in better shape than the guy that's spreading ill temper around, peeing in the glass that I want others to drink out of. There's really no place in heaven for a disposition like that, and a man with such a mood can only make heaven miserable for all the people in it. And you got to get past some of the 18th century language then. But isn't that, this is the whole area where I poisoned the marriage and poisoned so many relationships that were loving around there. Just a little flash of bad temper. I've done it time and time again where somebody does something, says something, and, you know, I just flash. One of them, I'll talk about it in more depth here in as we get to the 10th step. But our 10th step, and here I'll do this to be clear what I'm talking about. For me and for the purposes of this discussion, the 10th step is not something I do at the end of the night. It's for me, it's my spiritual antivirus program. It's operating all the time in the background. And here the world of the spirit is the world of the here and now. And so on 84, it tells us this step thoughts brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Sounds like a promise. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Sounds like a mission. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for my lifetime. That's how long I got to do it. So here are my directions. I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. By the way, what I'm supposed to be watching is me, not you, for these. I've become confused on time. When these crop up, I ask God at once to remove them. I discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. Then I resolutely turn my thoughts to somebody I can help. Love and tolerance of others is my code. So you listen to all the language there immediately, at once, vigorously, all this stuff. It's right here and now, and this is the relation where the relationship with God takes place. And for those that, you know, certainly, end of the day review has an important place, But this is really important because when I practice this, when I'm watching, it amounts to, like I said, antivirus. It's a men's prevention. You know, if I've got to watch myself, who am I going to take into this meeting? Who am I taking to go see my client today? Was I a little irritated with the wife? Am I a little worried about something else down the road? What's my attitude here? The same way the control tower will ask the pilot, what's your attitude when he's making his approach in? You climbing, you diving, you banking, you rolling, what are you doing? So I got to know who I'm taking in there. And then go through all of this. The image I used for the other thing, suppose I'm out walking my dog in the neighborhood and my dog takes a dump on your lawn. How would you feel if I said, well, Vadim, you'll be happy to know I'm a member of a very spiritual 12-step program. And before I go to sleep tonight, I'm going to consider whether my dog should have crapped in your yard. And if I decide my dog shouldn't have crapped on your yard, I'll come back tomorrow and clean it up. Have a nice day. My delay magnified the harm. It would have been no big deal if I just picked up the crap right then. It was the delay that causes the wound to deepen and get better. So I'm living right here, right now in this world of the spirit. The thing that the Drummond piece brought to mind, a few years ago, I was over at an insurance broker I use for some stuff, and I'd done business over there for a long time, and they treated me very well, and the owner's executive assistant was a real nice gal, and I had a great relationship with her and everything else, and she walked in, and I brought some paperwork over for a deal the day before, and I said, so you got that FedEx off right, because it was time sensitive, and she indicated she hadn't understood that she was supposed to FedEx it. Now I went into immediate, if this gets there a day late, it costs me over $40,000 is what the bottom line was in my mind. And I flashed, you know. I didn't swear at her. I didn't cuss. I didn't pound it. I didn't do any of that. But I carefully dissected her. I cannot believe how totally incompetent and, you know, just... Starting there, I just peeled her skin off. And I'm about three sentences into this, and I know I'm wrong. And I start trying to backpedal, but she isn't having any of it. And I eventually... I made amends quickly there and made further amends later on, and amends to her boss or the owner there. And, you know, this is what happened. See, what the real harm that happened there was she'd known me for years, and we'd had a good relationship, and it had been a kind relationship and all that kind of stuff. I made sure she had nice stuff on Christmas, and I remembered her birthday and her wedding anniversary and all that kind of stuff. So when I go off on her like that, it's like she's been bitten by the family dog. See, if some stranger had come in and copped that kind of an attitude, it would have been one thing. It would have been unpleasant. But it really hurt because it was coming from me. somebody she trusted, and I violated trust there, and I had, you know, because I know, and I bet you do too, I know who I can go to. I say, come on, that's no big deal. Come on, she made a mistake, and it could have cost you a lot of money, you know, and da-da-da-da, and they will get on board and co-sign my stuff. And, you know, I used to think when I do that, I was a smart guy, and I'm not. I'm the loser in that deal because, again, I'm creating the world I lived in. Now, it has literally taken me quite a few, probably on 4 years now. And Michelle, we get along okay. But it's not going to be like it was before. Because once the dog's bitten you, you're different around the dog. And some of that stuff. So having the consciousness, I failed to be, I just was going in and I was assuming everything was going to be hunky-dory and I was, you know, I was already spending the check I was going to collect from this thing. And so because I failed to watch up front, I created this whole mess right there. And this is really, really a wonderful way to live. And one of the things that brought me into my home group in the first place is that they used the 10th step as a 12th step tool. When I showed up as the newest guy in my home group, the old timer and a couple other guys got my number, didn't give me theirs necessarily, got my number and started calling with 10 steps to me. So I just nearly dropped dead when Gary, you know, Gary says, hey man, can I have a minute? You know, he says, I was dishonest at work this morning. And he laid out what he'd done, and he said, and I've asked God to set me on the right path here, and I've got an appointment to talk with the boss and clean that up with him this afternoon and all of that. And I'm saying, you know, this is the guy that's 21 years out in front of me. I said, oh, holy shit, they really do this stuff. You know, it's one thing. You can tell people about doing this stuff all you want to. But we can really draw people in and make them part of something. You know, all of a sudden, when those guys started calling me with 10 steps, I felt like I was in the club. It was an entirely different thing. It wasn't them telling me and teaching me. And so today I try and make sure that I, I'll give you one of my examples. A few years back, you may remember gas, at least in our part of the country, finally popped over $4 a gallon, and everybody was going crazy about it. And Costco on this particular day, gas buddy told me, my gas at Costco was 40 cents a gallon cheaper than any place in town. So I'm up at Costco in the line, get up to the pump, and I'm filling up, and this little pump attendant comes floating by and says, hey, mister, please don't top off. And I said, look, you little son of a bitch, when you start swiping your credit card in this pump, you can tell me how to pump the gas. Until then, I'll do it any goddamn way I want to.
That's an intense reaction. Right.
This is why there's no I'm a friend to Bill W. Bumper sticker on my just a little love from 12-step world. You know, you'd be happy to know I'm a recovered alcoholic. Yeah. So, again, just like with Michelle, I know I'm wrong right away. I'm not even finished. And so, because I there's no way I'm going to, you know, they change the people that are working there on a, rotate them on a basis, trying to come back and find this guy as a non-starter. So I made sure to grab him right now, and I said, look, man, I had no right to talk to you that way. I'm scared to death about where these prices are going. And I spewed that on you, and thank you for being kind and being here and doing your job today so I could, you know, could get this cheap gas and so forth. By the way, I'm sitting in my German luxury car while I'm spewing all this kind of stuff. Like, he might have well asked me, well, if you can afford to drive that car, mister, you can probably afford to pay the gas, you know. But he was kind, but... You know, so I'm driving away from there. I'm on my phone. I'm talking to the newest guy I'm working with, saying, hey, you know, your sponsor was just a jerk. And telling me, and then saying, hey, maybe we can, before the meeting tonight, we can stop by the Progress House and talk to some guys or, you know, whatever. I don't remember what it was at the time. And, of course, I ended up talking to some of my senior posse on there, but I'll tell you, it's good for me because it's ego adjustment and depth to talk to that newest guy right up there, and especially for me to keep my mouth shut if he's got advice for me and not just say, hey man, I got it covered, you know. I need to be willing to listen. So that's... The other area where I was really bad and got corrected on this is they've changed it around, but they used to have a valet parking, airport parking service I used. So I'd go out on this weekend and I would be Spiritual Mike all weekend, and I would, you know, I'd put up with the airlines and the lines and all this kind of stuff. I'm Spiritual Mike. Walk. Oh, it's no problem if the plane's delayed. No problem if the flight's canceled. But when I get home and that kid drives my car up to me, you changed my radio station. You moved my seat. I want to talk to your manager. You know. And you'll be happy to know I've been out helping the children of God all weekend. You know? You know, God Almighty. I mean, there's. See, I need this stuff more, not less. I really do. And thank God that you're willing to show up and play the game with me. Because I got no chance on my own. If it's just me listening to God, I'll run it through a couple of different distortion channels, and you know, it'll come out loopy. But anyway, this is really vital in the quality of my everyday life, and particularly in being happily married. So.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Gosh, that's my experience is so similar. I forget who I am, and I need to remind myself. And you know, I'm that power tool that I have to get plugged into the wall before I'm really useful. And it seems like it seems like a lot of stuff happens at work, you know, where I start to want to run my life and make decisions for my brain, and so I go to work early now. I used to, you know, especially when I was drinking, show up at the last minute, and now I get to work about a half hour early, and if you know me, I mean, I'm all about my time. I love having my time, you know, my time. I remember saying that to my sponsor once about my time. She said, ask me if I was going to help out on the Kiki Paw committee or do something. And well, I think that's a waste of my time. And she said, whose time? And I thought, oh, yeah, it's not really my time. It's on loan. So I get to work early, and I like ritual. I kind of like having a routine. And so I go and I connect. You know, I connect with a higher. I come and I change my clothes. I get into the scrubs and I... You know, see what's happening there, and but before I do that, I just sit and and just breathe in and breathe out and come and show up with me. You know, I invite God with me and get the lay of the land. And sort of like when you get a fish at the pet store, right, and they put it in the little bag with the water, and then you have to take it home in the aquarium, and you just let the bag float, you know, before you release the fish and let it sort of acclimate the temperature, and that's what I do. And because I don't know what happens. Sometimes it just seems like if I don't do that, like if I'm running late, occasionally this happens, and it's like a switch gets flipped, and I turn into this... And I'm not even a type A personality, but I turn into this crazy power driver at work, you know, and it's like I want to be, what I really want to be is, if I could pick my job, God, is I just want to be the wide receiver, you know, I want to run out there and oh, if you throw the ball, great, I'll take it and I'll run with it and do whatever, but I just turn into this, I want to be the quarterback, you know, like, give me the ball, just give me the ball, I know how to do this, you go there, you go here, and I'll get the lay of the land, and I'll make the decisions, and I'll be in charge. And that will happen when I get stressed. You know, I'm at work, and it's sometimes, especially if we're coming, it's just really busy, and everything's happening, and there isn't enough staff, and you just have to hit the ground running and go. And then I work with a team. I work with a bunch of people, and so on our little team, there's three or four of us, you know, and a night, and some of them are young girls, and they're in nursing school, and they have better things to do. They have homework, and they're 20, and they don't really want to do this. I mean, they're not focused on the job so much. And then, you know, there are a couple that are just legit lazy, you know. And I had some nurses say, how do you work with Heather? And it's like, well, I used to be Heather. And no, you were never like that. And I said, oh, yes, I would, you know, sleep it off over in the... And Heather, and I said, imagine this, I was Heather drunk. I would go to work drunk and hung over, so it would be even worse. And they can't believe it. They said, no, you were never that bad. I was like, okay. And so, you know, I get it, and I see that she's texting on her phone, and there's all this stuff burning up over here, and we have to move people to the other side, and somebody's having a baby here, and it's all happening at once, and they're just, you know, they're in first gear, and I'm in sixth gear, and that's really hard to take, you know, and I'm like, okay, and I look at that, and I think that's one of those places, you know, those character defects, I guess you could say, that why do I have to be this power driver in charge all the time? Why can't I be like sweet little Ashley Wood, who just, you know, she's just so sweet, and all the nurses love her, and all the patients love her, and she's just so kind and demure, and just goes with the program, and she goes, you know, at about in third gear, and she gets it all done eventually, and it's just so nice and pleasant. Why do I have to be this power driver? And the thing is that when the patient is coding on the table, I'm the one you want in the room. You know, okay, you watch the clock, you get the propylene, you do this, you do that, and it's, you know, you don't want Ashley Wood in charge of that. And so we all have our little place, and it's you know, it's my gift, but it gets out of hand, you know. It gets, I don't want to use it as a weapon. And so I have to, plug in my antivirus, and who's showing up today? Just be level right. If it's your turn to be the quarterback, don't be all about being, you know, just get the lay of the land. And so it's so important to just to plug in at first. And I do this too. I do a 10-step because I learned it from these guys. I do a 10-step with girls I sponsor, or maybe I don't even sponsor them, but they're new and I have their number, and I'll call and I'll say, you wouldn't believe one of the first times I did this, I was working in that restaurant as a bartender, and the bar was busy. I was the only bartender. The bar's packed, and I'm running back and forth. We serve food at the bar, and I'm running back and forth. And the dining room wasn't very busy. And so the waiters are standing around back there, and they're doing their thing. And so I'm flying back and forth. And it's okay. I mean, I don't need them to run food. It's all right. And I'm doing what I'm doing. I mean, it's right at a level where I'm busy, and I'm good. But this one fellow, that he doesn't like me, and I don't like him, and we just kind of stay in our own little... in our own little areas, and you know what's going on in my mind is that he didn't like me first. He's the one that has a problem with me, you know. And so, well, you know, I'm just going to treat him. And so he's kind of a wide-shouldered guy, and so I'm running back to get some plates back behind this little narrow area, and I'm just flying. I mean, I'm in my zone, and he's just, and he sees me, and you, anybody who works in a restaurant knows that, you know, if you're passing, you just kind of, you know, give him room. And this guy just sort of, he did a little, you know, hockey maneuver. He was just like tensed up like this. And I did a little hockey maneuver on him. I went, boom! And I knocked him down. His foot got caught up in the one of the high chairs. And I don't think, had the high chair not been there, he wouldn't have fallen down. But he hit the ground, and everybody turned around and looked, and they didn't know, like, what I did. I just finally lose it and go off on this guy. You know, kind of. He was just completely shocked, and I was busy. I'm like, oh God, this is bad. And I have to do what I'm doing. And when there's a moment, you know. And I said to him, you know what, we got to talk when I'm all caught up. Let's talk. Yeah, whatever. And I call one of my friends, new in recovery, and I said, you wouldn't believe what I just did. I don't think she was a sponsee. I said, you wouldn't believe what I just did. And she and I'm telling her, and she's on, and you can just tell through the phone that she's going, whoa, wow. And then I ask her, and what do you think of all that? And you can tell she's like, well, I don't know. Well, this is what I did. I told him I need to get back to him, and I said a little prayer. God, please help me. Please get me out of the way. And I'm going to need to talk to him, and I'm talking to you, and there's some stuff I need to do to get right, to get in my own right sizeness. And she's kind of going, yeah, that sounds good. But you know what? The way we interacted, she and I, after that, was it's almost like we're equals, you know? I'm not this big sober person up here, and with all this time, and you know, and she's got her 2 months or whatever it is. It's kind of like we share something, you know. You're just like me. You put your clothes on the same way I do, and that's really cool. It felt like she almost felt part of Alcoholics Anonymous. So yeah, it's awfully powerful. It's awfully powerful. When I first, it never occurred to me until I started going to the digs that you could actually do that with somebody. Because I thought I had to get some information. I'm all about the information, that I cause them to do a 10-step and they're going to tell me something that's going to fix it or ameliorate it in some way. And no, it's just sharing you and, you know, again, it's just you and me right here feeding each other, where the magic happens.
Yeah. That and the other thing is that if the question is always, particularly with Brown, you know, is, did you ask God to remove this, you know? And if the answer is not yet, you hear a dial tone immediately. So we get caught there. What you said about your time, that's we were talking about Screwtape here. One of the great things in Screwtape says, all you got to do to really mess with somebody's mind is let them believe that they awakened as the sole possessor of the next 24 hours. That way, everything, anything anybody asks them to do will be seen as a theft of their time. All you got to do is just believe it's your day, baby. And then anything I get asked to do, spending with Dad while I'm taking some of my time, you know, and doing all this kind of stuff. And so the whole thing was worth it just for the fact that I still do it, but there's part of me that hears, oh, you just started talking about your time, Mike. That's red flag, part of that spiritual antivirus going off. Okay, I'm in the mindset that this day is my day, and I'm not going to let you take any of it away from me, you know. And that's a setup for a disaster, and so I want to notice that. So they're obviously an outstanding set of, I think, one of the best sets of promises in the book associated with that, but we're kind of getting short on time, so we won't delve into that too much. But will meditation particularly has changed my life. I'll talk a little about it. Leslie's much better in this area than I am, but I was actually stuck in that place I didn't like, California, you know. Well, first of all, let me say, I got a when I was really new and before anything else, 60 days sober, God gave me a free sample here. A meeting I was going to, it was in the where the Nooner is now. It was not the Nooner then. But there was this guy down there, and, you know, you want what somebody had, and he had a very successful business, his own airplane, a German car, and a hot wife. So I wanted what he had. And he always, when he introduced himself at meetings, my name's Jim, and I'm a devout 11th stepper. So I thought, oh, okay, well, that there must be... Nobody else was doing that, so I thought, okay, fine. I never asked anything, buddy, about anything. Where would you find anything in this book, you know? So I grabbed the 12 and 12 and, you know, where they've got the steps right where you can find them, and opened up to step 11, and I'm sitting there at night in my bathrobe in this old lounger, and I sit there and start reading out of the 12 and 12 and then read that St. Francis prayer and I remember it kind of, okay, that was nice. It was kind of like I went someplace for a minute and came back and didn't think a thing of it. And then 3 days later, I'm sitting in a meeting, and they were mostly still smoking meetings then, and at that time I'm a smoker that upsets other smokers because I'm an active smoker. I don't light one and put it in the ashtray. I'm after it to the tune of about 3 packs a day, you know. And people just, you know, even other smokers are going to say, well, I didn't need to bring my own cigarettes today. Lorenzo's smoking enough for several of us. And so 3 days later, after this moment in the chair, I'm sitting in a meeting, and I watch the guy across from me light up, and I realize I haven't had a cigarette in 3 days, and I didn't quit. Smoking was just removed for 3 days, and they were right there in my pocket. And if you've ever smoked, you know what, that's just a reflex action. And I was horrified. He immediately got out a cigarette and lit one up. But what I got was, I got a sense, holy shit, there's some real power available here. And of course, I do what any good alcoholic would do. I went home that night, got the same robe on, and got the chair, got out my 12 and 12, got in the safe position, and got ready for my next magic carpet ride. And God loved me too much to let anything happen. One of those weird things. But see, now I knew, there was a part of me that knew there was power here. And so from time to time, I would dabble with a little meditation as I went along. But I wasn't terribly active at it. I would come to a retreat and do some, and I would do things, but it wasn't a real serious piece of business and practice for me. And I'm staying with my friend Jay and his wife Adele, and they've got this beautiful place in Redondo Beach and everything else, and I'm even though it was in California, they're really gracious and nice, and they have, and I noticed, I couldn't tell you, it's the kind of a house that it just pulled the quietness out of you. It was like it let the silence in you come out, and I couldn't figure out why that happened, and I realized that none of the TVs were on in this place. And I asked about the TV. Oh, well, yeah, we don't have cable. We keep the TVs here because we occasionally rent a movie and watch it, you know. But there was no... Now, my place, I've got a TV in every room, and it's on at all times. You know, it's the stock market's running, CNN's running, whatever's running, you know, something's going on, because I need to know. I need to be connected to the world. And in fact, it's even part of my business. I manage money. I got to know what's going on all the time. It's vital. And so none of this is happening at Jay and Adele's. And they did the craziest thing. One of them, I think Adele first, came up to me and just said very nicely, "Hey, Mike, would you sit with me for 3 minutes? Well, how do you tell your beautiful hostess you're not going to sit with her for 3 minutes? You know, if she asked for 10, maybe I could say, well, you know, I really don't have the time. But, you know, 3 minutes, you can't." And so they started tag teaming this, you know, between the two of them. 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 3 minutes. All, every time I'd run into one of them, I'd try and duck into a bathroom or something, because I knew I was going to have to sit. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's kind of like you can really put on some weight by going back and just grabbing a handful of that trail mix or a few of those potato chips at a time. Pretty soon you've acquired some bulk from this thing, and it works that way in the spiritual world, it turns out. And so I eventually, after, it wasn't the first visit, but after I had a couple visits with Jay and Adele out there, I went home and I turned off my TVs. Now, I wasn't quite willing to cut the cable yet. What I did is I turned them off and waited for a month, and then I cut the cable. But then one of my spiritual awakenings is I'm paying Comcast $168 a month to upset me. I mean, that's what it is. Listen to it. It's the message is be upset. You're inadequate. You need our product. And by the way, be upset. Even the weather's that way. You know, there's a front descending from Lake Michigan. There's going to be an avalanche of snow sweeping across Indianapolis. You know, it's never just, hey, it may snow tomorrow. You know, it's drama, you know. And so I literally realize my insanity is I'm paying people to agitate and upset me. And so I very slowly started this piece here, along with some other things. I read this, was suggested to me. I read this every day, front to back. It's about 11 pages. Read it for 60 days. Every day, read it, and then meditated for 20 minutes after I finished reading it. And it changed my, I don't know how it changed my life, but it changed my life. And so many other things. When Jess and I started connecting with each other, as I told you, one of the first things we did is we started building a spiritual life together. I think it was on our second date, I sat with her on the couch and I read this whole thing to her. You know, love is patient, love is kind. By the way, did you hear that? What the first quality of love is not hotness, sex, or money, or any of that stuff. It's patient. If I'm impatient, there is no love. I can be spending a ton of money. I can be doing this. I can be doing that. But if I'm doing it with an attitude of impatience, it doesn't mean a thing. This beautiful woman I love, I'm sitting here and I'm reading this, and, you know, and she says, "You seem like somebody I'd like to ship with." And then we started just holding hands and being quiet with each other for a couple minutes, and eventually we're meditating with each other a bit, and it grows. And eventually, when it came time for us to have that first time, I'm telling you with her permission, you know, there we are, we're naked in bed, it's finally about to happen, and she turns to me with that sweet smile of hers, and she says, "Honey, could we be quiet and meditate for 10 minutes? And I go, "Woo!" But you've trained me. You've taught me. I've got to pay attention. She just asked, in this sacred moment, she just asked me to be quiet with her. So we held hands naked under the sheet and meditated. And then we had that first experience. And what she said later both thrilled me and broke my heart at the same time. As you know, she's a victim of abuse. And she said, "Honey, thank you so much for being willing to take that time and meditate with me. After we meditated, it felt like my innocence had been restored." You just don't get to be a part of a bigger deal than that. Somebody's innocence can be restored. A child that was violated becomes whole again in the midst of this. And if you hadn't taught me different, I would have blown that moment. Because I would have just pushed it aside and said later and da-da, you know, or something. So this is a big, big deal, and it's a very practical deal. I used to think that all this stuff was just kind of, all right, well, it's nice if you can do it. It's kind of maybe a little extra stuff on top of the, you know, like the whipped cream on the top of my white chocolate mocha or something, you know. But I don't really need it, but sometimes I'll eat it. No, this is the essence. This is the essence of the good life. If I'm willing to step past my ego, it seems to show up and happen. So, Les.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Mike. That was powerful. I didn't know how to meditate. I've been trying to learn how to meditate all my life. I take books to bars and, you know, like I said, and just try. I was always looking, and I always knew that it had something to do with some sort of Eastern religion and sitting cross-legged and just zoning out, and I thought just being above it all was the goal. Somebody had pointed out in here that there's actually instructions for meditating in here. And you know, I'd intellectualize it that, there's a difference between, you can look it up, between contemplation and meditation, right? Especially if you ask a Catholic priest, they'll tell you. And how do you do it? I mean, it's the same way, like, how do you find God? How do you do this? You know, how do you go out into the forest and just feel your way around in the dark? And so, you know, it's been like a tractor beam for me. As I reach out, something reaches back. Sincerely reaching out, something just seems to reach back and just pull me in. And I find it by listening to you guys, really, is how I, what do you do? And I try all kinds of stuff, and I read things, and I try that. And I think that's the essence of it. You know, my brother doesn't want my time. My brother doesn't want my money. He wants my time, right? I have friends that they'll go down to the Wheeler Mission on Thanksgiving Day, and when the cameras are rolling, and they dish out food, and which is great. I'm not, you know, I don't know that I do any more, any less service work than anybody else. But what about going on January 10th? You know, and I'm the kind of person that will, when, you know, the Dove House comes around and they can I write you a check? You know, I don't really want to have to go there. Can I just, you know, stroke a check and, hey, I'm good. You know, I've done my contribution. But no, it's the impact of you and me right here. And I think it's like that way with God. You know, I don't, there's, there's not something, there isn't a method or a system, you know, that I can just find and just plug right in and then I'm good to roll. It's what I found, I have made a little sacred space in my house. And, you know, something interesting, when I went through poverty in recovery, again, I was what, like 14 years sober and lost it all, living in a one-room apartment downtown and driving this buy-here, pay-here truck and just not having enough money, and I'm going back to school. I felt like what happened, looking back on it now, like what happened is I came to the edge, lost it all, it's all in shambles, but like God just took his mighty arm and wiped everything off, and I wanted to reach down and pick it up. And God's, no, it's gone. It's gone. Don't reach down. It's you've got a blank slate here. And it seemed like God just started putting things that I needed here. And I felt like I jumped in the pool, like all the way to like, oh, here it is. I'm falling off the cliff and I'm going all the way down. I'm just going to go splat. And really what happened is I went ka-choom into this big, deep well. It just got it all over me. And so I'd sit in that one-room apartment. It was just me and God, just you and me. And I'd sit, and I had my one little meditation chair that I'd sit in. I had my little sobriety space with my books. And it felt like even when I had the monkey mind, that I just devoted the time. I'm going to sit here, and I'm going to sit here for 20 minutes. And time varies. Generally, I spend about 20 minutes. And I do things throughout the day, but then I'll have this time where I sit in my chair for about 20 minutes, and I'm just there. And sometimes it's quality time, and sometimes it's not. I'm all over the place. But you know what I do is I bring the body, and I sit there, and I say, you know, God, here I am, or form of it, God, here I am. And God says, good, here I am. And I come, and I have, you know, little things that I read, daily reflections, and you know, and I read from a Bible. It could be the Quran. If you can't read, it could be a book of Ansel Adams photographs. You don't have to read. And I sit there, and what I do now, and who knows what it'll be 6 months from now. It's been like this for a while, but you know, one tradition is called Lectio Divina. It's sacred reading. And so I'll come and I'll sit, and I think this is very powerful. I mean, you can feel that power when you read the book with a newcomer, right? And I sit there, and whatever it is I'm reading, I choose something, and I say, God, let it speak to me. Let it speak to me. And then I'll read it. It may be that I read the story of the prodigal son. You know, I was sitting downstairs in the room on the first floor that's closest to the door with the couches and so forth. And I was just sitting there looking out the window, and then I look up, and there's a painting, a Rembrandt. It's one of my most favorite. In fact, I read there's Paul Ferrini wrote a book, the story of the prodigal son, and he talks about his experience with this Rembrandt. Rembrandt painted a picture of the prodigal son, where he's on his knees, and the father is holding him like this, and the son is over to the side, the good son's over to the side, looking down on all this.
The Al-Anon brother,
indeed. and I look up, and there's that very painting right there, that Rembrandt. Take a look at it before you leave. It's so powerful. And so I may sit with it because I'm a prodigal son. And I'll sit with that story, and I'll say, let this wash over me. And ask myself these wonder, you know, it provokes questions, you know, in what way today do I pull myself away? Because if you don't know the story, the son wants his inheritance. He said, I'm out of here. I'm sick of doing all this, you know, farm work and everything. I want to go where the excitement is, you know. I got stuff to do. And takes his inheritance and goes, and he burns his life to the ground, and he's living in poverty, and he's just face in the dirt, surrendered, and he's no place to go. He goes back home like we do. We come back home, and he goes home, and he's so unworthy. How can I do this? You know, the way I treated you, I'm so unworthy. And the father says, oh my God, there's my son. He sees him walking from across the field. My son, come, please come to me. And you know, the son says, I'll do anything. I'll live with the pigs. I'll do anything. The father, no, come, and takes his ring and puts it on his son and come and let's have a party, and directs the good son to, you know, slay the fatted calf and bring it in so we can have a party. And you know, and the older son is like, what the hell? I've been here every day taking care of the farm, doing, you know, chopping wood, carrying water, being the good son, following the rules. And you're just going to, just like this, he can walk right in here and everything's done and after what he did? You know, and the father says, yes, he's our family. He's part of us. He's part of our soul and our heart. You know, and the son is just, I can't believe this. And, of course, the younger son is, I can't believe this, you know. Well, there, but by the grace of God, go I. And I I'll sit and I'll think about this. And I think, but God, I am so unworthy. Look what I did yesterday. Look at the way I talked to Heather. Look at all this kind of stuff that I do. Why do I do this? Why am I always walking away? You know, I come to you and then I always wander off. And I sit there with this, you know, and I take this and I trust that God is going to come in and just sort of, you know, knead the dough of my heart and till the soil and plant something in. And remind me, and so I get up and I go on about the day, and I think, let me take one thing away from this as I go, like the post-it note inventory, you know, take one thing away from this, and I can go out into the world, and you know, when I do that, and I do this, and I'm good about this, you know, when I open my eyes in the morning, before anybody knows, because if the dog knows I'm up, then. Then everything happens, right? So you know, before I really open my eyes, I have a little ritual. I say a little set of prayers. You know, God, thank you for waking me up sober, and go into a sort of a litany of things, and then I get up and go to the bathroom, make some coffee, let the dog out, feed the cat, and then I come and I sit in my chair. And you know, as I sit and breathe, really, for the most part. You know, I'll read a little something that I can take with me on my heart, but I essentially breathe. You know, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in. Breathing in God's love for me, you know, breathing out, I say, I love you, I love you, I love you, God. As I breathe in, listening to God, breathing into me the infinite love that is my very life, and going back and forth and back and forth. And it's a wonderful way to start the day, you know, and I do that every day for the next 40 years, you know. It's a wonderful way to live. And I can sure feel it when I don't. I know a gal that, it's fairly recently, she was talking to me about not having enough time, and I don't know how you do it. I used to build cars at the Toyota factory, and there was a gal that had exposure to AA. She'd been, her parents took her when she was like 15 or something, and she spent a little time in a treatment center. And she apparently not an alcoholic. She doesn't even drink. She told me about her experience. It didn't sound like she was an alcoholic, but she'd been exposed to AA and treatment and that kind of thing. And we were building cars, and so, you know, we build a car every 55 seconds. We walk, do this stuff in the car, and then walk back and get in the next car and build. And so we'd have this conversation. She was talking about her sister. Her sister was this good Christian, and how she gets up in the morning. She has these kids, but she manages to get up in the morning and pray and do all this kind of stuff. And if only she could be like her sister, and because I was telling her that I do that. And, man, I wish I could just be like you guys and get up and do that. She says, how do you do it? And I said, well, I think if I don't do it, I'm going to die. And she looked at me like, well, that's a little dramatic. And, you know, but the truth is, that's exactly right. It's not today, maybe, and maybe not tomorrow, but it's just a matter of time before I shrivel up and die. And so I had a sponsee who was telling me about how she, you know, she couldn't really do it. And really what she does is now she just, you know, she jumps in the shower and says a few things. And then she gets in the car, and then she'll have her cell phone. And she'll look up something spiritual to read. She'll read that on the way to work. And I said, well, it sounds like you have, you know, in the car. She said, I do my meditation in the car on the way to work. And I said, well, it sounds like it. You know, it looks like it on the road, really. I mean, when you go out into the world, that's exactly what it looks like you do, because I used to do that too. You know, I don't have time for all this, even though I love meditation. But when I do that, that reflects my day. That's exactly what my day looks like. And when I take the time, I think it's Francis de Sales. I read this in an Al-Anon book, a daily Al-Anon book, and it said, attributed to Francis de Sales, it is very important that one meditates for a half hour every day, unless it's a very busy day. and that an hour is required. And that's the truth, isn't it? I don't have time, and that's precisely the time I need to stop. And I think about all those things that I will take the time to do. I don't really have the time, but I can't think of anything more profound than this, but there's something I have, this little tick I have, that I have to face all my money when I get cash. All the presidents have to be facing up, and they have to be facing the same way. And I don't care how long the line is. It's like somebody hands me some money, and it's like, oh, it's like I have this OCD reaction to it or something. And I just have to, you know, I'll even stuff things under like this. I have to make sure that my money is faced as I'm walking out the door, take the time to do it. And, you know, I'll take the time for that. And how important is that? And it's awfully important, you know, in my life to connect and get the power. You know, I always had time to drink. I always had time to, I remember staying at my parents' house once. They lived out in the country. And I had to walk 3 miles to the liquor store. I didn't have a car. And I had to walk 3 miles to the liquor store. And I didn't think twice. That's just what you have to do in order to get things done. But, you know, sometimes I think twice about this. I'll say this in hush. There was a CD that I think you had handed out. I don't remember who it was, but this fellow was talking about how we talk about we're addicted to everything, right? And my drug of choice is more, right? My drug of choice, more sex, more food, more chocolate, more everything, except God. And I thought, oh, isn't that true? All the things that make me feel good. How wonderful I feel for that, you know, that flight, that magic carpet ride. And why do I forget? So easily. It's not like I'm, you know, get off work and, man, I can't wait to, you know, run back to that meditation chair and get with God. It's always, man, I can't wait to run down to FedEx and pick up that package that's going to be a whole lot more exciting than meditation. Yeah. What time are we?
Yo, 20 minutes.
20 minutes? Okay.
Yeah.
Or whenever.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, Les just reminded me, one of the things that popped up that reminded me of any links was I hadn't gotten the house foreclosed on yet, but the car had been repossessed, and so I was I needed to get to the liquor store badly, so I went over through the hedge over into my neighbor's yard, and I took his young daughter's bicycle, which was one of those short bicycles with pink streamers off it and everything else. And
oh
my. Mike's riding to the liquor store down. I don't care who sees me. I'm going to get to that liquor store. And see, yeah, and I try and think of that every time I think, you know, I can't do that, or that'd be, you know. The truth is that, yeah, I can do that. I can do that. So, I want to share another bit. I alluded to this yesterday, and so I kind of want to circle back to it. Now, keep in mind that we're talking about a 18th or 19th century evangelical here. And here's what he had to say, and when I make allowances for the differences in culture, this really moves me. Get the right. As you reflect on your life, the moments that stand out, the moments when you've really lived, are the moments when you've done things in the spirit of love. As memory scans the past, above and beyond all the transitory pleasures of life, there leap forward those supreme hours when you've been enabled to do unnoticed kindnesses to those round about you, things too trifling to speak about, but which you feel have entered into your eternal life. I've seen almost all the beautiful things God has made. I've enjoyed almost every pleasure that He has planned for man, and yet as I look back, I see standing out above all the life that has gone, four or five short experiences when the love of God has reflected itself in some poor imitation, some small act of love of mine, and these things seem to be the things which alone of my life abide. Everything else in all our lives is transitory. Every other good thing is visionary, but the acts of love which no man knows about or can ever know about, they never fail. And he talks about God on the judgment day, seated on the throne, dividing the sheep from the goats. The test of a man then is not how have I believed, but how have I loved. The test of religion, the final test of religion, is not religiousness, but love. I say the final test of religion at that gray day is not religiousness, but love. Not what have I done, not what have I believed, not what have I achieved, but how have I discharged the common charities of life. Sins of commission in that awful indictment are not even referred to. But what we have not done, by sins of omission, we are judged. It could not be otherwise, for the withholding of love is the negation of the very spirit of Christ, the proof that we never knew him, that for us he lived in vain. It means that he suggested nothing at all in our thoughts, that he inspired nothing in our lives, that we were not once near enough to him to be seized with the spirit of his compassion. I lived for myself, I thought for myself and none beside, just as if Jesus had never lived and as if he'd never died. And that's something. And what really blew my mind, this is an evangelical preacher telling me that the test of religiousness isn't some religious test, but it's love. How have I loved? Not giving them a resume of all the good stuff I've done, but where have I withheld love? Who have I failed to love? Who have I failed to be charitable to? These things. And, you know, he's talking about doing things for others and not getting caught at it. And, you know, this is the essence of what and who we are. And this is what captured those guys from the Oxford group that laid the foundation for our society. We're kind of closing in on the end of things, and I'd like to close with this, call it a meditation, a reading, whatever, but it both thrills me and breaks my heart every time I read it. This is the story of bamboo, an ancient Chinese legend. Once upon a time, in the heart of the Western Kingdom, lay a beautiful garden, and there, in the cool of the day, was the master of the garden went to walk. Of all the denizens of the garden, the most beautiful and the most beloved was a gracious and noble bamboo. Year after year, bamboo grew yet more noble and gracious, conscious of her master's love, and watchful in delight, but modest and gentle with it all. And often, when wind came to revel in the garden, bamboo would cast aside her grave stateliness to dance and to play right merrily, tossing and swaying and leaping and bowing in the joyous abandon of the great dance of the garden, which most delighted the master's heart. Now upon a day, the master himself drew near, contemplating his bamboo with eyes of curious expectancy. And bamboo, in a passion of adoration, bowed her great head to the ground in loving greeting. The master spoke, "Bamboo, bamboo, I would use thee. Bamboo flung her head to the sky in utter delight. The day of days had come, the day for which she'd been made, the day for which she'd been growing, hour by hour, the day in which she would find her completion and her destiny. Bamboo's voice came low. Master, I am ready. Use me as thou wilt. Bamboo. The master's voice was grave. I would fain take thee and cut thee down. A trembling of great horror shook Bamboo. Cut me down? Me, whom thou master has made the most beautiful in all thy garden? To cut me down? Ah, not that, not that. Use me for thy joy, O master, but cut me not down. Beloved Bamboo, the master's voice grew graver still. If I cut thee not down, I cannot use thee. The garden grew still. Wind held his breath. Bamboo slowly bent her proud and glorious head. And then came a whisper. Master, if thou canst not use me, but thou cut me down, then do thy will and cut. Bamboo, beloved Bamboo, I would cut thy leaves and branches from thee also. Master, master, spare me, cut me down and lay my beauty in the dust. But wouldst thou take my leaves and branches also? Bamboo, alas, if I cut them not away, I cannot use thee. The sun hid his face. A listening butterfly glided fearfully away, and Bamboo shivered in terrible expectancy, whispering low, Master, cut away. Bamboo, Bamboo, I would yet cleave thee in twain and cut out thine heart, for if I cut not so, I cannot use thee. Then was Bamboo bowed to the ground. Master, master, then cut and cleave. And so did the master of the garden take Bamboo and cut her down and hack off her branches and strip off her leaves and cleave her in twain and cut out her heart. And lifting her gently, carried her to where there was a spring of fresh sparkling water in the midst of his dry fields. And then putting one end of broken Bamboo into the spring and the other end into the water channel to his field, the master laid down gently his beloved Bamboo. And the spring sang welcome, the clear sparkling waters raced joyously down the channel of Bamboo's body into the waiting fields. Then the rice was planted and the harvest came. In that day was Bamboo, once so glorious in her stately beauty, yet more glorious in her brokenness and humility. For in her beauty she was life abundant, but in her brokenness she became a channel of abundant life to her master's world. And so it is with us. In our brokenness, if we allow it and use it, we become a channel of life into the world of those about us. And as Leslie's illustrated so beautifully, all it requires is the disappointment of my ego and the willingness to be useful and the openness to love. So thank you for loving us this weekend, and please remember me as loving you. Thank you.